Living, 1948. Living, 1948. Brought to you each week at this time by NBC and its affiliates in order to mirror more effectively the choice of leadership which faces us, Americans, in this election year, has made free time available for a limited series of programs to the declared candidates for the presidential nomination. Today, Senator Robert A. Taft of Ohio, candidate for the Republican nomination. And here is the regular narrator for Living, 1948, Ben Grauer.
Thanks, Bob Warren. Before we hear from Senator Taft, suppose you and I give our listeners a brief who's who account. Robert Alfonso Taft, son and grandson of statesmen, born Cincinnati, Ohio, September 8, 1889, present age 58.
Son of William Howard Taft, Chief Justice of the United States and 27th man to occupy the White House.
And Helen Herron Taft, daughter of John W. Herron, United States District Attorney for the Southern District of Ohio.
Education?
Robert A. Taft attended schools in Cincinnati and the Philippines, and the Taft School in Watertown, Connecticut. Graduated first honors by Yale University, 1910, and in 1913 by Harvard University, where he was editor of the Law Review.
A lawyer, then, by profession. As to his family?
Married, 1914, to Martha W. Bowers, daughter of Lloyd W. Bowers of Minnesota, who was Solicitor General. The Tafts have four sons, ranging in age from 21 to 31.
Now for public service.
First World War. Assistant Counsel for the Food Administration and Counsel for the American Relief Administration in Europe.
For which he was decorated by the governments of Poland, Finland, and Belgium.
Legislative experience began for Robert A. Taft in 1920.
With his election to the Ohio House of Representatives.
In which he rose to the positions of Republican floor leader and Speaker of the House.
He served in the Ohio Senate in 1931 and 32, where he was chairman of the Special Senate Tax Committee.
And entering the national scene in 1936, he was the favorite son of the Ohio delegation in the Republican National Convention. In 1938, he became Senator Taft, as we know him today, with his election to the United States Senate. In the Senate, his committee assignments have included
appropriations, banking and currency, finance, territories, post-war economic planning and policy.
And since the Reorganization Act, limiting senators to two standing committees,
chairman of the Committee on Labor and Public Welfare, member of the Finance Committee, and chairman of the Joint Committee on the Economic Report, and chairman of the Senate Republican Majority Policy Committee. Now, as a presidential candidate,
Senator Taft was Ohio's favorite son again in 1940, made a nationwide pre-convention campaign, in the Republican National Convention in Chicago in 1944, was chosen chairman of the Resolutions Committee, and drafted the Republican platform.
We take you now to Cleveland, Ohio, for an address by Senator Robert A. Taft.
Friends of the radio audience and friends of St. James Forum in Cleveland. At the election in November of this year, the American people must make a vital decision between two philosophies of government, one based on liberty and initiative and the dignity of the individual citizen, the other on an all-powerful controlling government at the head. At home, the New Deal introduced the idea of an all-powerful government, a planned and regimented economy, directing every farmer how to farm, every businessman how to run his business, and every housewife how to run her kitchen. They had to bypass liberty, equality, and justice to carry out their program and their theories. President Truman is still asking for power to restore OPA, WPB, rationing, and war control. He still demands socialized medicine and nationalized medicine. He still wants federal universal military training for 1 million boys a year and perhaps 1 million girls. The Republican program is based on progress consistent with principles of liberty and justice. We have cut government expenses over violent opposition from the New Deal still entrenched in President Truman's bureaus with thousands of press agents. We have cut taxes over the president's veto. We have reduced regulations to a minimum. We are working out plans to give this country a truly efficient and effective defense force based on the unification bill passed by this Republican Congress and an increased Air Force. In the field of human welfare, we are working on economic plans to maintain full employment. We are developing programs to improve the health, the education, housing, and welfare of the people without infringing on their liberty or on the independence of local communities and states to work out their own programs. The Senate passed recently my bill for federal aid to education without federal control, intended to assure to every child in this country, black or white, a minimum education. The Senate has passed recently my housing bill to give every possible aid and stimulation to the building of homes by private builders, but also including a limited amount of public housing, subsidizing rentals for families with the lowest incomes, and eliminating slums. We have rejected socialized medicine, but we are working on a bill to help states and cities and medical insurance funds to extend their activities. We present a liberal, forward-looking program in these fields, but based on individual and community administration and control and community independence. I wish to deal this afternoon especially with our action in passing the Taft-Hartley Law to restore justice and equality in labor relations, and justice and equality to the individual workman. This act has been violently attacked by many labor union leaders, calling it every name they could think of. They opposed all amendments, however, to the Wagner Act, and they prevented all amendments to the Wagner Act for many years, and they would have opposed any law that we passed. They called it a slave labor law, knowing that its express provisions preserved the right of every man to quit work and the right of every union to strike. It was President Truman who really proposed a slave labor law when in 1946 he demanded the right to draft railroad workers and coal miners into the United States Army on any terms he saw fit to impose. I alone was responsible for blocking the passage of that slave labor law. The new law was demanded by the people because first the whole prosperity of the country had been disrupted by unnecessary strikes, and second because the old laws were unfair and unjust. These laws were entirely one-sided and gave arbitrary power to labor union leaders to do any arbitrary act they desired without any legal recourse to the public, to the employers, or to the union members themselves. The New Deal never had any concern for justice or equality when they set up their various boards. The Republicans had the courage to put the Republican principles into effect and abolish special privileges in the interest of all the people. The Republican Party had the courage to keep its promises. The revision of the law was not inspired by any idea of vengeance or any prejudice against labor unions. The committee which reported the bill was largely pro-labor, and the pro-labor members took the position that labor itself would be benefited by a correction of the abuses which had arisen. We held long hearings, and our attorneys drafted the new law with instructions to correct only those matters where abuses were shown to exist. The new act is based on the same two basic principles as the former laws, principles which I believe are essential to the basic rights of labor, essential also to liberty and equality for all the people. First, the employer must recognize the union and deal solely with the representative chosen by a majority of his employees. This was the principle of the Wagner Act, and it is retained unimpaired. I believe there can only be equality if employees can deal as one unit, and if the employer is deprived of any power to deal with thousands of his men one at a time. The second principle is the right to strike whenever it proves impossible after a contract has expired to reach an agreement with the employer regarding wages, hours, or working conditions. If this principle is violated, there must be at least compulsory arbitration, and that would soon amount to government wage fixing. That would require price fixing and OPA and all the other controls of a totalitarian state, which destroy a free economy and freedom itself. Only in one case, in this law, do we limit the basic right to strike after notice is given. That is where the national safety or health is endangered, as in the recent coal strike. And even then, it can only be enjoined for a brief period while the government attempts to work out a settlement. It does not seem unreasonable to ask employer and men to maintain the status quo for 80 days rather than to subject the whole people to danger or disease. The new act attempts to restore equal bargaining power so that when the employer meets the union representative across the table, neither will feel that he can make an unreasonable demand and obtain any government support to back him up. The Wagner Act was completely one-sided, and the board was necessarily forced into acting only against employers. We left exactly as it was, the rights of the union to complain against the employers and unfair labor practices. We have, however, created also unfair labor practices on the part of the union and made the National Labor Relations Board a judicial body to hold the scales equal between the parties. We separated the prosecuting and judicial functions of the board, so that the concept of justice might return to government action in this field. We corrected many administrative procedures for the same purpose of securing justice and equality. We restored freedom of speech both to employer and employee. Since the whole basis of the law is free collective bargaining, leading to contracts between employers and unions, if there is to be an equality, we had to make unions responsible on their contracts and responsible for their acts under the same general rules of agencies as applied to the employers. The Act makes jurisdictional strikes and secondary boycotts unfair labor practices and makes the union responsible for damage resulting from those practices. No witness appeared before our committee to defend that racketeering type of strike. Even in this case, however, we did not restore the old power of employers to go into court and obtain injunctions. Contrary to what Mr. Stassen recently said, I did not favor such injunctive power. Injunctions against this type of strike can only be obtained by the government. The law has had a very beneficial effect in this field and apparently has reduced the number of these kinds of strikes. The number of strikes during the last half of 47 was only half the number in the corresponding months of 46. Because our law was drawn to meet specific abuses testified to before the committee, we found when we had completed the law that it contained more provisions intended to give protection to the individual employee, both union and non-union, against arbitrary action by his labor union officers than there were to give justice to the employer. A list of such provisions makes a bill of rights for employees, and I list them. A union shop cannot be imposed on any employee unless a majority of the employees vote for it. Even then, a man who is willing to pay his dues cannot be excluded from a job because the union arbitrarily refuses to admit him or fires him after he is admitted. Many unions refuse to admit colored men, but they cannot any longer keep him from obtaining a job even if they have a union shop. Unless we had changed the law, men could not work at their chosen occupations except by favor of labor union leaders, no matter how excellent their work might be. 3, the closed shop is entirely forbidden. 4, the board is given power to prohibit excessive or discriminatory dues. 5, unions are required to file financial reports with their members and an account of their dues and of their methods of election and procedure. 85% of union members favor that provision. Employees cannot be coerced by a labor union to join or not to join the union. 7, dues may not be checked off from an employee's wages unless he has filed a written consent. 8, if a welfare fund is established, of course out of funds which otherwise could have been paid in wages, the employee is entitled to have these funds treated as trust funds, properly supervised and audited, and administered equally for his benefit. 9, union members are entitled to prevent the use of their dues contributed for union purposes, perhaps to defeat candidates who are their best friends in any national election. It is fair to say that for the first time, Congress has interested itself in protecting the liberties of the individual workman, subject, of course, always to his being bound by a majority vote in choosing the representative who makes the contract for wages, hours, or working conditions. Talk about a slave labor bill is ridiculous when you read the express provision of the Act, which says that nothing shall be construed to require an individual employee to render labor service without his consent, nor shall anything in this Act be construed to make the quitting of his labor by an individual employee an illegal act, nor shall any court issue any process to compel the performance by an individual employee of such labor or service without his consent. The right to quit is absolutely unimpaired. The restraints of the Act are directed entirely at the acts of unions acting through their officers. What has really upset some of the more vociferous of the union leaders is not the enslavement of their men, but the very reasonable restraints on their hitherto unrestrained and arbitrary power over both men and the public. There is certainly a marked distinction between this law and that demanded by President Truman in 1946. He asked for authority to seize the railroads and the mines and draft all the workmen and the labor leaders into the army on such terms as he might see fit to impose. He could have marched men to camp or made them work without compensation at the point of a gun. He tried to rush the bill through in a single night, and I take some credit for interposing the objection. Second, the Act does not require any man to work for a wage fixed by the government. Third, the Act does not deprive the unions of any right of collective bargaining conferred by the Wagner Act. Fourth, there is nothing in the Act which restores in any way the right of individual employers to go to federal courts and secure injunctions against strikes. The employer, like the union, can appeal to the National Labor Relations Board to prevent unfair labor practices. But injunctions can only be granted on application by the government. 5, no restraint is imposed upon nationwide bargaining, even though it be in the nature of a monopoly. As the actual provisions of the new Labor Act have come to be known, opposition has steadily decreased. Countless labor union members have found that it is a good thing for them and for their families. Countless wives have found that it's a good thing for them and for their husbands. Labor union leaders, sincerely interested only in improving the economic condition of their men, testify that they are in no way handicapped in their collective bargaining by the provisions of this Act. The rights of unions are carefully preserved. Many labor union members realize now that labor's position today is much stronger with the public than it was before this Act was passed. Labor unions made themselves unpopular because a few arbitrary labor leaders chose to abuse the arbitrary powers conferred by the previous laws. But the country and labor union members themselves are finding that the Taft-Hartley law is working because it is based on justice and equality between men and their employers, while it protects every basic right which labor union leaders have fought for through the years. No one today that I know of is actively advocating the repeal of the Taft-Hartley law. The violence of the attacks has abated and is fanned only by those who took such an arbitrary position against any law that they cannot gracefully reverse their position today. I appeal, therefore, to all true friends of labor to support the Republican Party and to support those of us who have urged the passage of the Taft-Hartley law. I urge all people who have specific complaints to come in and offer amendments to that law. We have a committee which is considering those amendments. And insofar as those amendments do not restore any principles of injustice and inequality, I am sure that you can count on the fact that Congress will adopt those amendments.
We return you to New York. Living 1948 has today brought you the first of a limited series of programs in which we have made free time available to your fellow Americans who have announced their candidacy for the presidential nomination. Your speaker today was Senator Robert A. Taft of Ohio. And on May 16th, you will hear Governor Earl Warren of California. We invite you to listen next week to one of our regular drama documents suggested by the third anniversary of VE Day and entitled Then and Now. Living 1948 is prepared and presented for the NBC University of the Air. Robert Warren speaking. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.